All right, Jen Cooper, the Keeper here for the next episode of the Mix Zone Women's Soccer Podcast. This is podcast number 83. And so we have to give a shout out, of course, to Christine Sinclair and Aaron McLeod, both born in 1983, giving them a Canadian shout out today since we had the Canadian roster released same day as the U.S. roster for Olympic qualifying, and they were both named that roster. They will play all of their qualifying matches in Houston, and fans should note that the next goal that Christine Sinclair scores will move her past Mia Hamm on the all-time international scoring list. And hey, if she scores another 26 after that, she would pass Abby Wambach, who had 184 international goals in her career. So finally, we got the U.S. Women's National Team roster for February qualifying. So I had a nice long chat with Charlie Bohm of SoccerWire.com about who's in, who's out, and who's still on the bubble. Charlie shared the background of how he broke the story of Mallory Pugh possibly signing with NWSL, and we also talked a little bit about Canada's roster for the tournament. A note about our goalkeeper discussion, I read a comment from Jill Ellis afterward that mentioned she's required to take three keepers for the 20-player qualifying roster. Then I had a brief talk with Ireland's Megan Campbell, whose wickedly long throw-ins almost nabbed a goal for her team against the USA last weekend. Campbell won an NCAA title with Florida State in 2014, but after she completed her eligibility this past fall, she chose not to declare for the NWSL draft and instead pursuing playing opportunities in Europe. All right, Jen Cooper, the Keeper here with Charlie Bohm from SoccerWire.com, ready to talk U.S. women's soccer because, of course, we finally got the roster that was teased to us last Saturday, Charlie. They said we were going to get it Sunday. We got it today. It's Tuesday. I guess we'll take it.
Yeah, well, it's certainly people are have been waiting eagerly for this, and I think it gives people some things to chew over. But, of course, we do have to remember this is – not the final roster for the big event this year, which is the Olympics in Rio. This is a 20-person roster for CONCACAF qualifying, but regardless of what happens over the next 6 months, there'll have to be two places trimmed off of it for the very tight 18-player roster that will be used in Rio. And as you and I were just saying, despite a couple of significant absences from this latest roster, I think there's plenty that can happen in the next 6 months here.
Yeah, and I think it's important for fans and listeners to understand that Jill Ellis is by no means limited to this group of 20 people when she decides her 18 for Rio, especially since she does get four alternates for Rio. So, mm-hmm. You know, even though Heather O'Reilly and Whitney Engen, the two big names not on the list of 20, are not on this list, it doesn't mean that they don't still have a shot in some ways of getting to Brazil this summer. So let's talk first about those two. Those are our two active Women's World Cup players from last summer who did not make this roster. All the other ones from the Women's World Cup who aren't on it basically self-eliminated via retirement, current injury, or pregnancy. Of course, congratulations, Sydney LaRue. So let's talk Heather O'Reilly and Whitney Engen. What do you make of those players being left off this roster?
Yeah, the how news is, of course, the one that I think people are discussing the most right now, and it's understandable. I was surprised but not shocked given how marginalized she was in last summer's World Cup. You know, she's a fan favorite. She's a veteran. She's just a great locker room presence and brings so much to the table. But it seems as though Jill Ellis it just prefers other options, and her system has not necessarily been entirely friendly to wingers in the sense that for long periods under Ellis, this team has played with kind of a narrow midfield and asking the fullbacks to get up and provide width, so which has its pros and cons. And I think in the end, the look that they won the World Cup with and they played their best with last summer wasn't exactly that. And I think there is a place tactically for Howe here. But it seems as though, given the relatively modest sort of tactical options for a player like that, she just isn't at the top of Ellis's list. you know, you could kind of make the case that Howe is too direct of a player to fit into the more rhythmic sort of possession oriented style that we've heard so much about.
Right.
But of course, we've seen the women go pretty direct at times too, even in the new era. So so an interesting situation. And but again, I don't rule out Howe, because I know she's the type of person that's going to throw everything into NWSL play, and you know, much like Crystal Dunn last year. I think we'll make this a tough decision right down to when the plane takes off for Brazil.
And the good thing is, with the way the schedule is and where the Olympics are, she would actually have time to make a case for herself. Where, you know, last April, I think what the Women's World Cup roster was announced maybe 1-2 games into the NWSL season. So that was that. Mm-hmm. World Cup, I mean, the Olympics start a little bit later. I'm assuming that the roster wouldn't be named till perhaps June. So at least, you know, Heo and also Whitney Engen and other players would have a chance to show their stuff, you know. And of course, we've got the She Believes Cup in March. You know, we don't know how large that roster is going to be. I would assume a couple more friendlies. One of the things that I think about with Heo, I really think back to 2014, her last year with Boston, and how she ended up playing anywhere and everywhere. I mean, she was the glue that was holding that team together. And I think when you have such a small roster, not only for qualifying, but also for the Olympics with just 18, that kind of player, I think, can be so valuable, especially like we've seen her play fullback. You know, we know she can play forward. But like you said, I see that she's just not in Jill Ellis's plans.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, there's Ellis, even en route to a World Cup title, has sort of thrown up a pretty steady stream of head scratchers for us pundits to chew over, in terms of roster selections, in terms of lineup selections and formations and all sorts of other things. So there's, I think that angle of her tenure isn't going anywhere. We're still going to wonder if she really knows exactly what she's doing, or if she's one of the luckier coaches in program history. But certainly Engen is another interesting situation. It's a really talented young player who, or relatively young at this age, who made a lot of sacrifices to put herself back into the picture. And, you know, maybe is just suffering from having two really kind of all world, center backs. That iron partnership of Johnston and Sauerbrunn has, you know, really worked well, and maybe right. There just aren't enough places, you know, to fit her in behind those two. But I saw her as someone for some time now. I've seen her as someone who should be a long term starter, someone who's got all the tools you would want from a center back on this team. But she'll have to wait a little bit longer, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. And when you look at the other people cut, they're not so much surprises. You know, Adriana Franch, the fourth keeper, just, you know, good to see her get a camp. Same as Rose Lavelle. Danielle Colaprico, I know a lot of fans still waiting to see her first cap, you know, and then LaRue was the 26th player in the camp. So not a huge cut for this camp, but none of those, that 26 did not include, of course, Chrissy Rampone, Megan Rapinoe, who we saw during the game Saturday, an update on her rehab. You know, she's still an outlier. It's going to be really tough to make those cuts for Rio, even with all of the, you know, retirements that have happened since the Women's World Cup.
It's true. And there's also a process of generational change and evolution happening here as well. It's pretty powerful when you see that in many ways, O'Reilly's spot was taken by a 17-year-old, you know, Mallory Pugh. Ellis has clearly made rejuvenation of this squad a priority. And it's hard to argue with that, given how long in the tooth women's national team squads generally are,
right.
And specifically over the, you know, the last year or two here, this was, you know, really that World Cup was the end of a cycle for a kind of a generation of players, and then there's others always that have to make tough decisions about their lives off the field and how they want to find that balance, and so I think that process continues and. You know, makes things a little more interesting, I guess, when we look at, you know, some of the different personalities and some of the different combinations that need to take root over the next few months.
Well, and I don't want to be a hypocrite and say I don't like the change, because, you know, I was definitely one of those people last year where it's like, we need to see some younger people come in. Of course, you know, we knew it wasn't going to happen leading up to the World Cup, and we started to see a glimpse of it this past fall. So it is nice to see that there has to be that turnover, even in such a short period as, you know, June 2015 and August 2016. We've seen it before in the transition between World Cups and Olympics, when it's only that year window, but you got to keep rejuvenating the team. And someone who, in some cases, you know, hung on for the next World Cup, you know, it's like, it's not, I don't think it's good for the team, you know, to, okay, well, but these people, well, it's just one more year. Maybe they can play one more year, you know, where it's like, no, let's put together the best possible team that we have. Old or young, let's put together the best possible team. But speaking of young, definitely want to talk about the 17-year-old Mallory Pugh, first 17-year-old capped by the U.S. national team in 9 years. And it's funny because so many people think she's the youngest capped. It's like nowhere near it. Tons of 17-year-olds, a couple 16-year-olds, and even Mia Hamm at 15. But it's just been so long since we've had young people capped. So talk about what you saw in her performance Saturday against Ireland.
Well, it's hard to think of a better way to introduce her to the full international level. This is a very talented player who's been in big situations, as big a situation as you can present a young player in the youth national team setup. You know, she was the star of the last U20 cycle, even as an underage player. She is so young, in fact, that she's eligible for the next two under-20 World Cup cycles. She's been on the lips of women's soccer diehards, really going back to when she was 14 or so. All that being said, it is still a big step up, and she's got a lot of growing to do, both I think in the game and possibly even physically, because this is a very slight young lady who may yet even have some physical growth still ahead of her. She's so young and she's so undersized. But that being said, get to come in a game that's already well decided, and getting a goal, you know, really instinctive finish on her part is a perfect way to bed her in here. I think, again, there are some tougher lessons ahead of her and a lot of questions for her to answer. But when you look at from Ellis's perspective, just a, you know, great occasion for Pugh and a promising sign, I think, for everybody, especially fans who are ready to see what the next generation has in store. So, you know, Pugh's a player who, you know, when I talk to insiders about her, she scores goals. I mean, she's the most important thing I would emphasize to fans is the finishing instincts. And we saw those against Ireland, stealing in, you know, really is surrounded by a crowd of Irish defenders and still right, finding her way to the ball. Kind of that instinctive understanding of what Kristen Press, who served her the cross, was going to do and when, and the perfect timing. And again, you know, even against a team clearly second best like Ireland was to the U.S. and typically is to the U.S., to get in there amongst, you know, veteran defenders, you know, fully adult defenders, and get that finish is great for her. But what I'm watching from Pugh is, you know, will her brain be able to keep her at this level and catch up to this level the same way that her body already has? You know, she's a quick player, she's aggressive, but she hasn't necessarily had to outthink players much, many of her peers, right, to date. So that's the next challenge, I think, for her.
Yeah, when you look at highlights from the CONCACAF under-20 tournament in December, you know, she got golden boot, golden ball. It's really hard to judge how good she is because the competition just doesn't seem very fierce. You know, it's similar to watching some college highlights. It's like, well, it seems like this person's beating everyone, but maybe she's just that much faster, you know, and you want to see that player get in a situation where they are having to beat defenders who are the same speed or who are larger or, you know, something like that. Kind of, you know, back in the day, we saw the transition for Abby Wambach of moving from college to international, where it's like, no, you're not necessarily bigger than everybody. You know, how do you play when you don't have that natural advantage? So yeah, I am looking forward to see how she greets those challenges, and having the confidence from that first goal in her first game, you know, and what a way to connect with Kristen Press. Mm-hmm. You know, I really like Kristen Press's energy on that goal, getting all the way to the back line and be able to make that turn, you know, and of course Pugh reading it, you know, so like you said, instinctive finisher, so much there to look forward to. And this is just the third teenager since they started Olympic qualifying to be on the U.S. squad for qualifying. Haya, of course, made it in 2004 for the qualifying tournament. Tobin Heath, just a hair under 20 years old, she was when she was in the qualifying tournament in 2008. So Mallory Pugh, just the third teenager. And I also want to talk about, you know, an article that you ran last week in Soccer Wire about, you know, the rumor at the time that Mallory Pugh was going to sign a professional contract and end up playing in NWSL. Now, we know now that, or at least for now, it's not going to happen. But talk about that story and how it developed and what you heard.
Yeah, and it's interesting because being at the in the media tables at the NWSL draft two Fridays ago, was it now,
right,
in Baltimore?
Right.
You and John Yardley were over there. You know, we're a few hundred feet away from us. You know, commentating on the live stream that NWSL provided for the draft, which we didn't have that audio. So I had kind of understood in general terms that you guys were discussing this rumor that was making the rounds,
right,
both the night before. And I remember thinking it was too outlandish to even possibly be true the night before.
I know when I heard it the night before, I told Dan LaLetta that Jonathan and I would streak the convention center if it happened. So in a way, I kind of owe that to Dan, but since she still hasn't signed, I guess I don't.
Well, I kept hearing it, and I couldn't help thinking that, I mean, really, what it was, I think when you know, eyebrows shot up when the league announced a significantly new or updated player allocation process for national team players. And the, you know, we'll come back to this, hope maybe, but the wording in that new allocation order scenario is I think intriguingly vague, and I think we'll be discussing that possibly for years to come. But in this case, you know, for that to happen, for that release to come out right as the draft is about to start, which is really throwing a wrench into everybody's idea of what's possible,
right,
in the draft, and then for the Portland Thorns, who are the Days Wheeler Dealers, who are generally, you know, the most ambitious. And right now the most driven team in NWSL in terms of, you know, not just what they do off the field, but the underachievement on the field, which kind of has reached a low point, I think, last season. That club is really fired up and ready. They're determined not to miss the playoffs again. They're determined to have their on-field performance match the off-field performances. And that also, you know, when they traded to grab the first spot in this brand new allocation system, there was just so much smoke. So I started digging around for fire, and it turned out there were some people that were ready to speak freely on it, and confirm that basically, you know, just something that's really quick developing situation here with Pugh, who is a high school senior, doesn't turn 18 until end of April. Had always been discussed as the next big thing, but it was still seen as sort of, I think, both by the nature of her build, as I mentioned earlier, and you know, the fact she's so small and she has elements to add to her game. It didn't seem like she was necessarily the type to go and pursue a move like Lindsay Horan did,
right,
a little over 3 years ago now, to go directly to Europe from high school. But I gather that, you know, the Federation saw enough from her in the both the U-20 and the senior team environment had conversations with her parents about her readiness to keep pushing herself. So, you know, I gather that they did their best, both the Federation and the NWSL, which are, of course, effectively the same entity. They were realized they had this player who had bigger ambitions and who possibly was interested in departing from the usual, was really an overpowering norm, I think, in girls soccer.
Right.
You know, college scholarships are everything that, you know, most of your listeners probably know this, but there's, because of Title IX and a variety of other factors, there's a lot more scholarship money out there in Division I women's soccer than there is for the men.
Right.
There's obviously not the same professional pathway, but which adds up to NCAA soccer being an even more dominant part of the landscape for the women than for the men.
Right.
But I think we're realizing that, you know, there are limitations to the women's college game the same way that the men's limitations have been so painfully exposed in the MLS context over the last few years. And so the idea that this player was ready to upset that conventional wisdom and go straight into the pros, and you have to give the Federation and the league credit for acting, being nimble enough and ambitious enough to try and set up a situation to provide this player with what she needed. In the end, a few days later, Pugh's father spoke to the Denver Post and sort of tried to pour cold water on the whole idea that she would have had decided to go pro, and the way that Horace Pugh sort of picked his words, I thought was very interesting. I would never question the veracity of what he was saying or anything along those lines, but I thought he picked phrases specifically that gave a little bit of deniability while trying to put aside the idea of going straight to the pros. And I think my opinion on this is that if we assume that Mallory Pugh told the people in charge that she was ready to do this, and her family, said they're ready to do this, and then had second thoughts, it's completely understandable if her dad would want to make it very clear that she didn't do anything that could endanger her college eligibility.
Definitely.
NCAA has some very thick, arcane rule book in which there are certain triggers that you set off as you consider a professional career, and there's sort of these little milestones, and one of the, for example, kind of crossing the Rubicon is picking an agent. You can shop for agents, but just selecting an agent, not even involving payment. You don't have to pay the agent, but just selecting an agent is kind of a Rubicon in terms of it can end your career, your college career, and if. She was put in a position, I think, where somebody, a rival school or whatever, anybody down the line wanted to throw shade on her UCLA career. Conceivably, they could exploit some part of the process the negotiation process that she pretty clearly did have with the Federation and the league. Her father said they did not speak to Portland Thorne's staff at any point. But they wouldn't have had to, because the Federation would be the one she would be signing a full-time contract with as a member of the women's national team pool. She could go through this process without endangering her eligibility all the way up to the point of actually signing that professional contract. So very interesting situation. And I'm, again, much like the Olympic roster, I'm not entirely prepared to write off the possibility of Pugh going pro early just yet. I have a feeling that there may be more twists in that tale. She doesn't have to report to UCLA until August.
Right.
NWSL season starts in April. Maybe she changes her mind again. Maybe she leaves college early, which even now is still sort of not done on the women's side of the game. So a lot yet to be determined there. But certainly, regardless of what her dad says, I stand by my original reporting, and I think the other reporting that was done around the media suggests that this was very much happening. One important source did tell me it wasn't a done deal, and I reflected that in my reporting. But this was set up, and there was, I think, whether it was second thoughts or reconsiderations or whatever you want to call it. Pugh is ultimately here decided not to do this yet, but I do have a feeling she's got maybe an unconventional path ahead of her as she develops her career.
Definitely, and I like that you brought up about, something could still happen. And, like you said, season starts in April. She doesn't report till August. Also, maybe she doesn't get named to the Olympic roster, so she does want to go to college or not. Or, we also got the under 20 Women's World Cup, I think late October, so it's factoring all that in, okay, how much will UCLA get to use her if she's busy with that, also, of course, a potential victory tour if she makes the Olympic roster, and then if they win and there's a victory tour. So many different pieces of this puzzle for her. And I also like thinking about, okay, so what if she did go to UCLA for this fall, but then chose to leave college early? We don't have any precedent for that. WSA, WPS, and so far NWSL has always made it clear, one of their draft rules is, you must have completed all of your college eligibility before you can declare for the draft. So say she wants to leave college early, does she still have that allocation path? Does she end up going through the draft? Mm-hmm. Even if she's allocated, does that mean that maybe does that allow for a college player who's not allocated to say, well, I want to leave college early and declare, you know, it's a lot of interesting stories down the line we can tell already.
Yeah. And it's intriguing too, to talk to other, NWSL clubs and staffers, because, early reaction to this possibility, or this, you know, this idea of Hugh going pro and going to Portland, which apparently her parents had, her family had requested Portland. And we can imagine a number of reasons why they would do that, but the most pressing one, I think, is that there's family. Her sister, her older sister, just finished her, I guess it was last year, finished her college career at the University of Oregon. Uh-huh. So I gather there's, you know, if you look at putting a teenager straight into the pro environment, they were taking steps and picking her destination in such a way that that would set up a platform for her success and a stable environment, which is understandable. And again, you have to credit the Federation for being nimble in that respect. But that is still a player picking their destination, which is supposedly a no-no under the allocation system. And there's, I think there was a little bit of resentment simmering there at that happening. And then also the fact that it's perceived as a rich getting richer, right?
That Portland,
so many resources already and so many benefits, would be getting this. But from what I understand, you know, they were ready. They can offer an environment that a lot of other NWSL clubs can't, that would be helpful for her growth. And, you know, I still don't know. I mean, Amanda Cromwell at UCLA is a great college coach, and that's a great college program. But Mark Parsons has done pretty darn well in his coaching career, and you could certainly make a case for the Thorns being a significantly upgraded, you know, developmental environment for Pew. So it's a lot of fun stuff to consider here, and from what I hear, this is not a one off. There are going to be other players who are going to come through the system who are ambitious and ready to go straight into the pros or get a fast track into the pros. So these rules we're talking about here, much like MLS has come up against, they're going to hit their limits, and I think it's up to the league and the federation to try and find an equitable, transparent way to evolve with this changing landscape.
And as you mentioned, NCAA's rule book is so thick and arcane that, you know, playing in NCAA, it's so restrictive. So it's not necessarily the best way to develop a soccer player, even if you have such a great program as UCLA and a coach like Amanda Cromwell. You know, your off-season time is so controlled by all of those rules. I mentioned this on my podcast last week, talking to Dan LaLetta. Like, could you imagine if one of the Women's World Cup champs from last summer still had NCAA eligibility? Because in 1999, Lori Fair did, and she turned down all of the reward money, all of those endorsements, and played her final season at North Carolina. And some people are like, oh, but it was 99, the money was less. Like, no, we're still talking six figures.
Yeah, that was legit money.
Yeah, it's not like she was turning down $5,000. She was turning down some serious money, you know. And I wonder if Morgan Bryan had been 1 year younger last summer, you know, would we have seen the same thing? And I think, you know, what's very different is not so much the amount of the money, but the landscape, you know, and the other possibilities out there. But speaking of money, I do want to bring up another name on the roster that was released today, Stephanie McCaffrey. You know, now the question is she going to be allocated by the national team? You know, she wasn't on the allocation list that came out right before the draft, but she was on this roster. And as far as we know from the CBA that right now is really just a memo of understanding that's good through the Olympics, once you've been in camp a certain number of days, they have to either let you go or activate a contract. And it seems like she is hitting that, I think it's a 90-day window.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
So if she's in for February, you know, does she become allocated? It sounds like, but of course we're not, they're not always transparent about those details.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I suspect that she will be, and I think that's part of the reason. I don't know the specifics yet on the size of the allocated list, but I think the Federation is absorbing the cost of, what was it? I think it was as many as, 26 in the past, maybe even bigger, the number of players whose salaries, NWSL players who are in the national team pool and thus have their salaries picked up by the Federation. You know, I think they've set it up that way for flexibility, because the players that they want to have in the league. They want to be monitoring. They want to have control over those players' environment. That's not always going to correspond perfectly with the group that you want to take to a given tournament or a given match. But I suspect that Ellis has a sort of, you know, let me pick who I want and we'll sort out the details later. And
as it should be, more power sure, to her if that's what she's saying, especially when four of the current allocated players aren't active. You know, LaRue, Rodriguez, Rampone, Rapinoe. You know, it's actually the smallest active allocation list we've had in the history of the league.
Well, and the other angle with the pregnancies too, and I don't have the CBA in front of me, of course, but you know, we hear legends of how ironclad, how strong the women's national team CBA is,
right.
And my understanding is that you know these players, even though they're missing out on the Olympics, but by having their pregnancies at this point, they're also effectively insured. You know, the similar compensation levels. You know, most or all of their agreed compensation level and a lot of the other health benefits, a lot of other really crucial aspects of that CBA are still in effect for them.
Right. I mean, it's maternity leave and it's a great thing to have. I think it's strange that it was already a smaller allocation list than we had seen previously. And when you look at the number of injured players in the allocation list, like, okay, well, shouldn't some other people be, I don't know, semi-allocated or partially funded? And of course, there's still so much of the behind the scenes that we're not privy to. I mean, it's much like Shannon Box allocated as long as she was towards the end of her career. It's like because she was injured and then pregnant, it was per the CBA that she was still entitled to that slot. And I don't deny her being entitled that so much as, but shouldn't she be developing someone else at the same time? You know?
Yeah, it's a tough spot, mostly I think for me in that it just underscores how dramatically different life is for a women's national teamer compared to a rank and file NWSLer.
Right.
And cases like McCaffrey and so many others drive home the point that the talent gap sometimes is not that big. It's just not.
Right.
And if you get on that allocated list, your life changes in substantial ways. You know, you triple, quadruple, quintuple, whatever it may be, your salary, you get access to a whole new level of training and health and fitness infrastructure. I mean, it's just so many things. And I certainly hope that the long-term vision is to spread those benefits more broadly across the NWSL. But right now, there definitely is a gap there. You know, there's a gap between those players and there's a I think, a simmering issue in terms of identification. You know, many of those girls on that – those women on that allocated list see their loyalty as first and foremost to the national team and the federation. And it's understandable, but it's also problematic because it could come at a direct cost to the NWSL and the clubs that are in there, you know, scrapping to make it. So you know, I think it's a great story with McCaffrey, for example. That's a player who's directly benefited from the presence of the NWSL. The system's working just as it should for her. You know, she's taken an opportunity. She's proved herself. She's hauled herself up to that next level. I think the allocation system and the money side of it and the federation will catch up, but in the meantime, you know, she's I think we have to continue to keep that avenue open and keep that pipeline working. And sometimes it seems as if the CBA of the national team almost works in opposition to that.
Right, and it's just fascinating for all of us to follow. You know, it's always something different happening, always something new and unexpected. Just makes it more exciting for us. A couple more questions for you, Charlie. I'll say, so we have three keepers on this roster of 20, which, you know, some coaches might just go with two keepers into this tournament and, you know, keep an alternate. But Jill Ellis chose to call all three from the World Cup, Solo, Harris, and Nair. They have five games between February 10th and February 21st, so pretty tight window, less than 2 weeks. I'm hoping that means that we will see minutes given to Harris and Nair. Now, am I deluding myself, or what do you think?
Well, I think Ashlyn Harris has done as much as anyone can as the number two, and I still consider her the number two at this stage, at least. She's done as much as you can do as the understudy to sort of an all-world dominant goalkeeper like Hope Solo, who I think is the greatest goalkeeper in women's soccer history and is up there in all soccer history.
Right.
As much as some people hate to hear that and are
you cannot deny her accomplishments and just what a fierce keeper she is.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's exactly. always a chance, you know, she's not, you know, invincible. She could get hurt. You know, we've seen that. You've got to be prepared.
And there can be some very subtle sort of a subtle erosion of form and technique and certain skills with a goalkeeper can happen and you don't really realize it until something disastrous has happened in a game.
Right.
And actually, my friend and colleague Liu Yu Bird, who writes over at Sports Illustrated, who is himself a former goalkeeper and coaches goalkeepers up in Washington. He's talked to me about, you know, over the last, I think he would probably say a year or more, Solo has shown little twitches, little hitches that suggest maybe her technique is not as impeccable as it once was. And there could be any number of reasons for that. There could be a lifestyle question. There's just simply the onset of age. But, I think that goalkeepers' reputations tend to outlast their form a little bit. We're seeing this with Tim Howard at the moment. You know,
true.
It can be very tough for goalkeepers to, I guess, to maintain that aura, or I should say that the aura maybe sometimes lasts a little longer than the actual form, the actual performances justify.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And of course, you know, they always talk about how, you know, you can get more out of an older keeper because their decision making. You know, their leadership, their ability to communicate. And I think they can use a lot of that to cover where they may have a loss of form. I mean, I really feel like 2011 was her peak because she was coming off that surgery she had in 2010. You know, she missed Women's World Cup qualifying. She missed that spring leading up to it. But Pia Sundhage had said, you know, when you come back, there's a starting spot waiting for you. And I feel like she was on fire during the 2011 Women's World Cup, except the final, you know, and mm-hmm. then she was stellar through 2012. But if you go back and look at that USA Canada semifinal in the Olympics, it doesn't do a lot, you know, for her, you know, it's like now, and it's not fair when she's played almost 190 games to pick two and say, hey, this is, you know, two that make her look bad. But I just feel like, yeah, I think we do that. That's a good way to describe it. Your slight erosion, you know, of form. But if the defense is so used to having her behind them, you know, that's part of the puzzle as well. I just feel like regardless who's starting, the people that aren't starting, especially if they don't have a lot of caps, they better be getting some caps in the next couple of months.
Yeah. And Ellis has not necessarily been, doesn't seem to have been very attentive to that matter. But thankfully, you know, there's thankfully for the team, I should say, with Harris, you have a really similar personality to Solo, different person, but similar sort of hard edge. She has a sense of drive. I think she knows that that her time may yet come. And I think she's the type of person who can handle waiting in the wings, which is a psychological challenge to any player.
Right.
And I think that's. You know, it's one of the toughest jobs any coach has is evaluating each player, each selection situation, and knowing when a player needs support, when a player needs to know that they're valued and that they're important, that there's a place for them on the field, versus when that player needs a fire lit under them and needs to be challenged
right.
and be shaken out of a comfort zone. You know, we hear comfort zones all the time, right? Because it's one of Jurgen Klinsmann's favorite talking points. But you know, it's not always the case that a player needs to be, needs to be slapped upside the head per se. There's a time and place for that, and there's a time and place for standing behind someone and underlining your belief. I think many of Solo's coaches have gotten it right by offering her support and validation, especially when things are rocky for her off the field.
Right.
We may be coming to a time when she'll need to be. She'll need to get a little bit of cold water dumped on her in order to keep the fires alive. If I was the coach at this moment, I think I'd probably lean towards stoking that competition a bit more than we've seen to date. But you know, Ellis has her way, and we'll see how she maneuvers that.
And it'll be really interesting to watch this NWSL season with both Harris and Nair at new clubs. You know, Harris going to Expansion Orlando, kind of going back home. Nair having a shot at being with the club that's, you know, made the playoffs. It's going to be fascinating to watch. All right, but last question for you, Charlie. Oh, wait, you're going to say something?
Yeah, well, it's also, you know, if history is any guide, this expansion team down in Orlando is probably going to get carved open regularly. So Harris is going to be busy back there in the Nets, whereas Solo is on a really a very established, very successful team up in Seattle that may not test her to the same degree.
Right.
So those two club environments could also prove quietly influential.
All right, so the Canada roster came out today as well. And, of course, we're not Canadian, but we pay attention, of course, to the hat of the U.S., as some people call Canada.
America's hat.
Yeah,
yes.
A lot of NWSL players there. You know, a lot of fans of this team as well in the U.S., just because I think they had a great run last summer, and I really like watching a lot of these players play. And, of course, you know, we're all pretty sure, right, that Khadisha Buchanan will be the first pick in her NWSL draft. Mm-hmm. But so the roster came out, and it came out ridiculously early, 7 a.m. Eastern, and we learned today that was for Canadian morning TV, so that they had players on all the Canadian morning shows, so it was timed for that. But of the roster that Canada put out, 20 people on the roster, 13 are from last summer's Women's World Cup. You had 10 players from last summer cut, including, and I think these are the big names, Lauren Sesselman, Kaylin Kyle, Adriana Leon, Janelle Foligno, and Carmelina Moscato. So, you know, John Herdman going young, mixing things up. They've got the U.S. beat. They have a 16-year-old on their roster.
Yeah, well, you know, Canada has punched above their weight for a long time, and Herdman is, of course, been a part of that. He is also, though, you know, he's there's a little bit of a cult of personality with Herdman, and my understanding is that behind the scenes, he's an even more dominant, sort of strong personality who really wants to set the tone for his players. He's known for coaching with an extreme level of organization. His training sessions are mapped out to the foot, to the point that he wants his players drilled so well that. You know, the system is so well ensconced in them that they don't have to think in a given moment. You know, so he's in that sense, he's very much a control freak, and I think he had to have looked at last summer and the Canadian team in general over the past year or more, and been really troubled by the absence or the shortage of attacking dynamism. You know, this is not a team that was creating chances at will, even on home soil, with big crowds behind them, you know, at the Women's World Cup. This was just a kind of a stout, sturdy team that was really short on inspiration up front. So given that, I mean, it's almost surprising that someone like Melissa Tancredi is still in the picture here. You know, obviously Christine Sinclair is a legend, and I think you've got to select her as long as she's walking and tying on boots. But other than that, I think it's time. This is a Canadian team that needed a little bit of a page turned and some new faces, some new matchups and competitions. And I think that they've got work to do ahead of them to be where they want to be for the Olympics, starting with qualifying next month and then going into the tournament. It's a smaller tournament. They've lost all those advantages they had as the host nation last summer. But it's time, you know, and I think we'll only see Herdman's influence shine even more now with this group, because the younger players are going to come in and be even, you know, more open to his methods. They're going to be apt pupils, and so that certainly benefits him and what I know of his nature.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note, you know, like you did with the U.S. team, or like we both did with the U.S. team, that even though it's a pretty short window between the Women's World Cup and the Olympics, it's like this is always a good thing. You know, it's like there were some people that were kind of at the end of their playing window last summer, but yeah, you've got this Women's World Cup on home soil. You want to be a part of it. So I'm going to be really interested to see what happens with Canada next month, especially as their group is really weak compared to the U.S.'s group, since CONCACAF didn't really do seeding for these groups. So, you know, Canada playing Trinidad and Tobago, Guatemala, Guyana, not going to have a group stage that really preps them for the semifinal, where it's all or nothing. You win the semifinal, you go to Rio, you lose, you don't. Mm-hmm. You know, there is no third place playoff. There's no extra slot for that. And with the U.S.'s group being so tight, U.S., Costa Rica, Mexico, Puerto Rico, I mean, we would expect, of course, that the U.S. would win that group. But Costa Rica could, you know, could catch Canada off guard. I mean, I would hate to see that happen. As exciting as it would be to go, oh, my God, Raquel Rodriguez is going to the Olympics. Like, I think that's going to be a tough semi for Canada.
Yeah, and it actually reminds me of the men's Olympic tournament, which happened last year in the fall, and now the U.S. Were not great, but they were certainly good enough, and they were pretty composed in the group stage. And then they had their hiccup at the worst possible time. They played a poor game and were deservedly beaten by Honduras in the semifinals, which immediately changes the whole complexion of your tournament. Now they've got to, they're able to beat Canada in the third place game. And now the U.S. men, it's a significantly different tournament, you know, because of the U23 limitation that FIFA puts on the men's tournament. But now they've got to beat Colombia in a two-legged playoff in March, and it looks really rough for them. So the Canadian women, I think, are in a similar spot where it's a delicate balance. They've got to try and build momentum, use that weaker group to build momentum in the group stage, and then be really ready to go whoever they find themselves up against in the semifinal, because that's the cup final.
Well, Charlie, thank you so much for talking about all this and sharing the backstory of the Mallory Pugh article. Really appreciate that. And definitely looking forward to seeing more from you on that and a lot of women's soccer topics.
Yes, thank you so much. Always a pleasure to talk to you, Jen.
All right, Jen Cooper, the keeper, here with Megan Campbell from the Irish Women's National Team. Megan, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk first about the game against the U.S. women this past weekend. Tough game. It's always pretty tough to go against the number one team in the world. But how did you think your team did, and what do you guys think you got out of it, you know, as you're looking ahead towards qualifying for the Euro?
Yeah, definitely. As you said, obviously going up against the world champions, you're going to always come into a tough game. But, I mean, we battled hard. It's obviously tough when you're playing against the likes of Carly Lloyd, and obviously Abby Wambach is retired now, but they have a legacy within that team, and they're a tough squad to come up and play against. But obviously, we look to our European qualifiers, and we use this as preparation for them. So we knew coming in here, it was a test for the future, for what's next, you know, for us. So we just used it to see where we could progress in areas and obviously test ourselves against the best. Obviously, the scoreline didn't go the way we wanted it to or close to where we wanted it to go, but I think we fully enjoyed the game and we got a lot from it.
And there's a lot of young players coming in to camp for Ireland, it seems like, Grace, and I'm totally blanking on her last name now, who's actually from Texas and plays for Texas A&M. You know, it's nice to see Ireland able to pick up players, you know, who might have some American connections and use them for the squad.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, youth is a big part of squads nowadays. You know, as teams get older players retiring, they need to bring in the youth. And luckily enough, we have a good youth system, which is progressing at the minute in Ireland, and so we have a lot of young players like the likes of Savannah McCarthy, Kate McCabe, Claire Shine, Megan Connolly coming up through the ranks. And as you said, then we also have, when we come on these trips, the opportunity to get to play with and train with American kids who have Irish ancestry in them, like Grace Wright and the other two girls that came and trained with us during the week. So it's always nice to have that diversity, I guess, within our team and to be able to bring them in and let them see what the next level is like, and to give them the opportunity just to, you know, take in the surroundings and how they're going to adapt to that big step up.
Well, I was impressed to see that Ireland had qualified for the U17 Women's World Cup in 2010, and you were part of that squad, and they reached the quarterfinals. So, you know, it's nice to see the development on the youth side of things. So talk about how women's soccer or women's football has grown in Ireland over the last several years.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I was as you said, at the U17 World Cup, it wasn't a women's youth football was as big, but in the past 6 years, I mean, it's grown so much. There's and now a women's national league that's set up and progressed within the country, and there's more and more teams growing within it, and more girls wanting to play. There's summer camps, and, you know, I guess the whole surrounding since the Women's World Cup and how big of a deal it was. It's brought up a lot of attention to women's soccer. And then obviously you have Stephanie Roach, who was up for the Puskas Award, and that brought so much attention to the women's game, and it was so good for us to be able to have that attention, not just for herself, obviously, for the wonderful goal, but to have that for the women's game, to be able to have somebody and people recognize that we are trying too, you know. And obviously we don't have the same money and, you know, the funding as a lot of other countries have, but what we have, we're trying to use, you know. And the game has definitely grown a lot. There's a lot more young girls interested, and when we play home games with the national team, there's so much more fans there, and so the game is gradually growing and it's going in the right direction.
And it's going to be a pretty tough road to qualify for Euro 2017, because it looks like just the group winner advances and then some of the second place, you know, teams in each group, but not all of them. So how do you feel Ireland's chances are in your group?
I mean, you always have to be optimistic, you know. We didn't really get off to the best start, losing to Finland at home, but we grouped together again, and we beat Portugal 2-1, and then obviously you come up against what a great side of Spain, you know. It's always hard to play against those when they're so technically good on the ball, you know. But I mean, we know that in the next four or five games that we need to get at least 9 points from them, and so we're going to be going into every game needing a win and focusing on each game as it comes.
Talk about playing in the United States in the college system. You just finished up your career at Florida State, you know, grabbed a national championship, you know, with the Seminoles, you know, played with a lot of great players, and also under Mark Krikorian, who, you know, coached professionally in the U.S., the first women's pro league in the U.S. back in the day. How did you decide to come over to play in NCAA?
So, I guess at the age of 17, I really hadn't made my mind up of what I wanted to do, and so I stayed in Ireland, and I did 2 years in college, which I think is what made me mature a lot, you know, as a person, as a student too. And then over my second year, obviously, I had contact with Mark Krikorian, and he was interested in having me over. And so back and forth, we spoke, and until I eventually came over on an official visit. And I mean, once I made that trip, there was no way I was going to turn down the opportunity to go to Florida State. It was a beautiful campus, beautiful college, and great people, and to be around the facilities and, you know, the opportunity that I was being offered. As I said, I just couldn't turn it down, you know. And then when I did come here, the team, Mark, the whole, I guess, everything that was involved in it was just so professional and so such to a high standard that I really enjoyed my time here. And as you said, then we won a national championship, and playing in, I guess, some may consider the top league in Division One soccer for women in the ACC league. We won it the 3 years I was there, and so I was happy to, you know, play with some, as you said, some of the best players that were at Florida State and in America at the time at college soccer.
Right, and you had mentioned you were watching the draft last week, so you got to see several of your teammates selected by NWSL teams. Can you talk about the decision to not declare for the NWSL draft and where you're thinking of going at this point?
Yeah, well, obviously, being so far away from home for the past 2.5 years was tough to take. My family and my boyfriend are back this side of the water, so I think for me, I just wanted to come back and be closer to home, basically, and see my family and spend some quality time with them, hopefully play closer to home, even though it is across the water if I was to go professional. But yeah, I think anywhere in Europe, I would be looking to try and get myself into a club over there and just progress as a player, basically. You know, I know coming out of college and going professional, you're not always going to be a starting player at teams, which is what I hope to look to achieve, but I know there's a long road ahead of me, and I've got still a long, good few years to go within my professional career if it goes the way I want it to go. So, I mean, I'm just going to put my head down, work hard, and if I get a team, I'm going to focus on getting my starting position.
And maybe down the line, if things change, you know, would you leave the door open for coming to NWSL?
Yeah, definitely. I've spoken about it with my boyfriend and family that after having this experience over in the States, that I'd love to come back to live here one day, just even maybe even coach myself, coach a team, you know. So I wouldn't close the door on maybe coming back and finishing out my career, or even just in the next few years coming and playing over in the States. I mean, it's a great opportunity for people to come and play against the best. And as you can see, the U.S. national team aren't half bad. So to be playing against them week in, week out, I wouldn't really mind that, you know.
Yeah, definitely. Well, last question for you. I want you to explain how you developed such an amazingly long throw-in, because that's certainly a lethal weapon for any team to have.
Well, I mean, I wish I had a great story to back up the long throw, but unfortunately I do not. I guess when I was playing U14 with the boys team back home in Ireland, I threw it one day and they said, do it again. And so I guess the next throw I got, we did it again and again. And I guess as I grew up, it just gradually got longer, you know. And so I've never trained it. I've never, you know, done anything to try help it get longer. It's always kind of been that length, and thankfully the teams I've played for, we've taken good advantage of it. But it is a nice weapon to have.
Yeah, it certainly got some attention. The place where I was watching the game, the U.S. Ireland game yesterday, a lot of people were like, "Who is that? Who did that?" So it's like, oh, that's Megan Campbell, and sadly she won't be in the U.S. league, but maybe down the line. But Megan, thank you for talking today, and you know, good luck to you in Ireland as you try to qualify for the Euro 2017.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me, Jen.
All right, time to wrap it up with the back four. First, WOSOKO. Mark your calendar. The first ever Keeper Notes WOSOKO, which means Women's Soccer Conference, will be held Saturday, February 20th in Houston. This is the day between the CONCACAF Olympic qualifying semifinals and final. So if you're traveling to Houston for that weekend, you don't want to miss this event. WOSOKO will feature sessions led by Hal Kaiser of KeeperNotes.com and myself. Plus, there will be a Q&A with special NWSL guests. For more information, check out keepernotes.com, click on WOSOKO on the main tab. And feel free to email me with questions at keeper@keepernotes.com. Next, speaking of that weekend, if you're looking for a great hotel deal in Houston, Bayou City Republic, which is the Dash Supporters Group, organized a special deal at the Wyndham Hotel in the Texas Medical Center. It's not very far from BBVA Compass Stadium, and it's within walking distance of stores and restaurants. Check out Bayou City Republic's Twitter feed for the link, and please don't wait to do so. The offer expires this Friday, January 29th. Bayou City Republic is also co-hosting a party with me at the Phoenix Brew Pub on Westheimer that Saturday night between the two match dates, and all fans are welcome. All ages are welcome. Next, Olympic qualifying update. One more team has qualified for the Olympic tournament in Rio. New Zealand beat Papua New Guinea 7-1 in the first leg of the two-game Oceania qualifying series. But then in the second leg, unfortunately, Papua New Guinea failed to show up, so New Zealand secured its berth to Rio by playing just one game. So there are now seven teams set for Rio. Host Brazil, Germany and France from Europe, Colombia from South America, South Africa and Zimbabwe from Africa, and now the Kiwis. Five more spots are up for grabs. CONCACAF will get two of them. Asia will get two. And the final European berth will be decided by a four-team playoff among Norway, the Netherlands, Sweden, and Switzerland. By March 9th, the field will be set. Last, we're going to call this Kit Notes to go along with Keeper Notes, but this is Kit Notes. There are new U.S. women's jerseys coming in late March, both new home and away kits. Apparently a new lettering style for the back. And yes, the kits will have the FIFA Women's World Cup champion patch. The men's and women's jerseys will apparently be the same. You know, the men's team will be getting a new jersey at the same time. So that means if you buy a men's jersey, it won't have three stars and it won't have the FIFA patch. Now, my store can add three stars to any jersey, but unfortunately not the patch. FIFA controls that patch very closely. They don't want it sold as an individual item to be put on something that's not an official jersey. So only the women's kits are going to have it. Not sure what they're going to do with the youth jerseys yet. We'll see what happens. The national teams will also be wearing new keeper kits, most likely the Nike Gardien jersey that comes in seven colors. We just don't know yet which color they'll be wearing. But once we do, I can continue to make custom keeper kits with 3 stars, whatever name and number is desired, just without that pesky FIFA patch. Just won't be on the jersey. Also, NWSL teams are finalizing their jerseys for 2016. All teams will have at least one new jersey. Some will have two. All teams will likely be in that same Guardian goalkeeper kit. So look for new jerseys to be available at nwslshop.com in mid to late March. My store in Houston, Soccer for All, will have dash kits at some point, and general gear now is available for all NWSL teams, including cinch sacks, polos, jackets. Just email me at jen@soccerforall.com for details. All right, that's it for this week. If you're not already subscribed to this podcast, really, I don't know what's wrong with you. Just kidding. Subscribe via iTunes, or you can find the podcast at howlermagazine.com/podcast. It's available Podomatic, Stitcher, TuneIn. And please, if you like what you're hearing, please tell other people about this podcast. Last, certainly not least, thanks to PK Ray for making this podcast possible.